Billed as the world's largest event for the library community, the American Library Association Conference underway in Anaheim features appearances from the likes of Dan Rather and Gabby Rodriguez. He, the famous news anchor, she, the 17-year-old trickster who staged her own pregnancy. The ALA programming also looks at digital publishing from a multitude of angles, including ebooks, research, and the digital lives of tweens. A survey released at ALA for the Pew Internet and American Life Project surprised many with its findings on the numbers of ebook borrowers. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the news that everybody's going to be talking about when they get back to work on Monday. And joining me first on the show from Anaheim is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hello, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us. We appreciate your stepping away from the programming for just a few minutes to tell us about what's been going on at ALA this year. I understand once again that ebook lending is all the buzz.
Once again, ebook lending is the big thing that hangs over the meeting, the ALA annual meeting. So you're right. I'm in Anaheim. It's gorgeous here. Here it's a bit hot back there on the East Coast. But the hot news here at the conference is being generated around a survey that was released this morning from the Pew Internet and American Life Project on libraries and ebooks. It offered some surprising findings, and I'm sure that these results are going to be discussed heavily over the course of the show next week. And I'll report on them more fully next week as well. But I wanted to give you a few highlights. According to the report, just 12% of American adults who read ebooks say they have actually borrowed an ebook from their library in the past year. That's low. And you may remember that in April of this year, Pew reported that 21% of American adults had read at least one ebook. So now we see that just 12% of that 21% has actually gotten one from a library. The survey also found that most of the public, and not just ebook readers, are generally unaware that they can even borrow ebooks from their libraries. And that's even though more than 3/4 of the nation's libraries offer ebooks, some ebooks at least, for lending. So 62% of respondents to the Pew survey said they had no idea if their library offered ebook lending. And that included 58% of all library cardholders. So people who use the library often don't know that they can borrow an ebook. So this level of, you know, shall we call it ignorance about libraries and ebooks, even surprised the Pew administrators, who said they expected a greater level of awareness, especially given all of the attention that has been paid to libraries and major book publishers in the last year.
Well, it is a very surprising result, Andrew, and I would imagine, as much as anything else, it's a marketing failure. The libraries haven't told people enough about ebook lending to make them fully aware of it, perhaps.
It's possible, and it certainly suggests that there is a great opportunity for libraries to get this information out there. But I think it also probably has a lot to do with, frankly, limited offerings and limited staff time to put towards, you know, pushing ebooks out there.
Right. Well, you know, we don't want to fault the librarians too hard. As you say, some of it has to do with the offerings. That's going to change. Penguin Group has announced it's going to be returning to the game.
Yeah, sort of. So the other big news this week, of course, is that Penguin, which pulled its books, ebooks last year from libraries, announced that it's going to be initiating a pilot project with 3 New York City library systems to get, you know, back the game, kind of. So there's still some details that we're not sure about, but the broad strokes are that Penguin's going to make its entire catalog available on pretty limited terms. They're going to window ebook releases to libraries, meaning that new releases will not be available for the first 6 months of a title sales life, and the books will expire after 1 year. So if all goes well, according to Penguin's terms, whatever those are going to be, it's then going to expand its library lending. But perhaps most notably, Penguin is bypassing leading ebook vendor Overdrive and using 3M for the pilot. 3M has been making inroads with its platform, but if this pilot is successful, ostensibly any library that wants to lend Penguin ebooks is going to have to get on 3M's platform. So, you know, a few things here, and I'm going to speak personally and not necessarily on behalf of PW here. And I've spoken to a few librarians so far at the show. And the reaction is along the lines of, it's great that Penguin is back at the table. I think that's, you know, mostly right. It is good that Penguin came back to the table. And if this is a true pilot at the end of this year, maybe some adjustments can be made. But this is really, you know, barely a step back towards the table. And as this is structured now, I think it gives Penguin just enough to say that they are working with libraries without giving libraries enough to work with. For one, windowing new releases for 6 months doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I mean, consider this. In that 6 months that you're windowing, a new title could only be lent 13 times. So how much damage can that really do to demand? At the same time, so much of a new title's demand comes in that first 6 months. So doesn't it make more sense to lend these new titles and encourage libraries to buy up more copies to meet demand at its highest? You know, one thing we know about libraries and ebooks is that you're going to wind up on a hold list. And that hold list could actually be a great way to spur people who don't want to wait to borrow the book to actually go and buy it. But if you take that first 6 months where you can't borrow the book, and then you take the next 3 to 6 months, which is, you know, easily, you know, what you're going to wait out of hold, it means that those without means, that those that don't have the money to go out and buy the ebooks they want right away, are going to be relegated to second-class readership. So I know libraries can't be happy about that. Now, as for the one-year expiration, this is worse than the HarperCollins 26-lend limit. At least with HarperCollins books, you'll remember, if you don't circulate 26 times, or excuse me, you can circulate 26 times, whether it's in a year, whether it's over 7 years. But with Penguin, if you buy the book and it gets borrowed twice in a year, you lose it. So, you know, Penguin said this was designed to, you know, quote, mimic the wear and tear of print. But I don't know. Two lens does not seem like it's mimicking print. So, you know, on the one hand, there's this school of thought out there among publishers that digital books are going to last forever while print wears away. But in fact, I think the opposite is proving to be true. Books last on library shelves for decades. And this is why libraries often have to weed their collections. Print is durable, but, you know, I can't even open iTunes on a Mac that I bought 4 years ago because the operating system won't support the latest browser. And I have piles of floppy disks with documents that I'll never be able to access again. So digital does not necessarily last forever. There's a lot of upkeep that needs to go into that. And if you look at the ebooks of today, I'm pretty sure that they're not going to, you know, last as good old deacidified paper. And at the same time, you know, that mimicking print thing, librarians would be happy to mimic print. In other words, let them buy the books, curate collections, and lend them to users. That would be mimicking print. So, you know, the big winner here, I think, obviously, is 3M. This is a major opportunity for them. And if their platform proves, you know, very flexible and everyone's happy, I think that they're going to get in the game in a big way and compete with Overdrive. And all of this brings me back to Amazon, because as you recall, this all began with Penguin dumping Overdrive over its program with Amazon that actually passed on library borrowers to Amazon to be lent a book to read on the Kindle. And if you've read the Department of Justice stuff, which I know you all have, you're probably aware that Penguin's CEO is a little bit concerned about Amazon. In pulling its library books from Overdrive, Penguin said that it wasn't about revenue, it was about security risks, that they were worried about patron privacy and all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, how does windowing and a one-year lend limit address security concerns? When they pulled their books, we could speculate that this was all directed at Amazon, but now that we see the plan for getting back in without Amazon's partner Overdrive in the mix, we kind of know this isn't about security now. We know that this is about business. We know that this is about revenue. And by the way, Overdrive says no Penguin books were ever compromised. So, you know, this is a pilot. We're going to see what happens. And as you know, libraries are happy because they want Penguin back in the game, and they do care about business. They want publishers to do well. But I think if we're being honest here, while libraries are going to applaud Penguin for coming back to the ebook table, this kind of plan gets applause shows you just how deep a problem the ebook really presents for libraries, especially in light of the Pew findings, which says in essence that readers are shifting to digital quickly, but libraries are not shifting quite so quickly. And that's not a good situation.
Well, something that is good, of course, is ALA's continuing love affair with books. You mentioned that. And the conference celebrates reading and authors. A number of really stars are going to be appearing. I saw John Irving on the list. In that vein, they've announced a new book award.
That's right. I think this is one of the great things that libraries do, and this is going to be a real hit, I think. On Sunday night, I'm going to be at the first Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction. So this is, as you say, a brand new adult book award. And I think it's going to be a great addition. You know what libraries have done in terms of the Newbery and Caldecott Awards, I think shows that they're going to be great judges here and they're going to do a lot to sell books. And hey, they can't do any worse considering the controversy over the Man Booker Prize or that the Pulitzer Committee didn't even pick a fiction winner this year. Six great books are up for the award this year. For fiction, it's Russell Banks' Lost Memory of Skin, which is published by Echo. Anne Enright's The Forgotten Waltz, which is published by Norton. And Karen Russell's Swamplandia, which is published by Knopf. In nonfiction, there's James Gleick's The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood, which is a fantastic book, published by Pantheon. Manning Marable's Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, published by Viking Penguin. And Robert Massey's Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman, published by Random House. So, you know, it's not all about ebooks here. We're going to celebrate authors, and that's something librarians do better than anybody.
Well, reporting from Anaheim, Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genre Ville. She brings word, as always, of a variety of reviews this week, including a new one from Booker winner John Banville, writing his Benjamin Black and the fifth in his series featuring the pathologist Garrett Quirk. So, Rose Fox, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thank you very much. Always good to be here.
Well, why don't we start off with some fiction then? Tell us what we have this week.
Sure. We've got a couple of big reviews. David Gillam puts a fresh spin on the horrors of World War II in City of Women. He focuses on an unassuming German woman who takes a Jewish lover and then becomes involved in the resistance. And our reviewer called it a stunning debut about the battle between good and evil. It has transcendent prose, powerfully drawn characters, and multi-layered dilemmas, which lead up to powerful revelations. We also highlight another debut novel set in World War II, but unlike City of Women, Tigers in Red Weather, an unnerving literary thriller, is set in Martha's Vineyard. It focuses on two female cousins who spend their summers at the family's lakeside estate and whose lives were touched in different ways by an unsolved murder in the community. And the author, Liza Klausman, is, coincidentally, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Herman Melville. For Q&A and fiction, we spoke to Vanni Ratner about her debut novel, In the Shadow of the Banyan. Ratner was a young girl when the Khmer Rouge took control of Cambodia and threw her life into chaos, and she writes about her experiences in the novel. When we asked why she didn't write this book as a memoir, she said she wanted to tell this story in a way that would honor the lives lost and those who made monumental sacrifices to save her. So she feels her responsibility as a survivor is to elevate the spirits of those whose lives were cut short.
Well, that's pretty dramatic indeed. And in mysteries and thrillers, we do have something from John Banville coming up.
Yeah, he writes as Benjamin Black for Vengeance. This is the fifth in his series set in 1950s Ireland and featuring pathologist Garrett Quirk. And one day, a wealthy man takes a 25-year-old, the son of his business partner, out for a sail, tells him a story about a lesson in self-reliance, pulls out a gun and shoots himself in the chest. And that sets off a mystery that takes the pathologist all over the place looking for clues and solutions. Paul Doron wrote Bad Little Falls. This is the third featuring game warden Mike Bowditch, who has been exiled to Maine, which he considers the equivalent, has exiled to Maine's equivalent of Siberia, Washington County, because he offended the powers that be by shooting a murderer in self-defense. And his search for a man missing in the middle of a blizzard leads into a murder mystery with some truly wicked twists. And we have a Q&A with Greg Hurwitz, author of The Survivor. That's a thriller whose hero suffers from ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig disease. And he has nothing to lose when he decides not to leap to his death off a tall building, but instead to interrupt an armed bank robbery. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we have a really interesting debut novel, Charlotte Markham and the House of Darkling by Michael Boccacino. This is a note-perfect rendition of a spooky Victorian. It's got the gothic atmosphere. It has dramatic dreams, a governess who tutors the sons of a widower. You can see all of the pieces lining up. And our reviewer says that Boccacino's deft handling of this delicate supernatural period piece makes it a standout debut. We also review, this one sort of brings a lump to my throat, Shadow Show. This is a collection of stories in celebration of Ray Bradbury, edited by Sam Weller and Mort Castle. I was delighted to see that Bradbury actually wrote an introduction to this piece, to this collection, because it means that he got to see it before he died. And it's just a wonderful tribute. And he writes that these authors are his fantastic brethren from all over the world. It's just one knockout story after another. Some of them evoke Bradburyan themes, and others spin off of his work or show its effects on a variety of characters. It's a fine remembrance of a great writer and a deeply moving testament to his enduring appeal. And we have an unusual anthology edited by Charles A. Tan, who's better known as a science fiction blogger and critic. He has assembled an eclectic and innovative mix of Filipino-Chinese speculative fiction stories in an anthology called Lauriate, L-A-U-R-I-A-T-E. And most of them contain undertones of horror. While a few of them are a little predictable, they all contain these evocative details of Filipino-Chinese culture, readers from that culture will feel a real thrill of recognition, and others will be glad to learn more about it.
Well, romance adds to that assurance that the only thing for certain is death and taxes, that maybe some romance could be involved, because there's an IRS attorney that figures in the new book.
Yeah, Julie Garwood's Sweet Talk. This is a great premise. A woman whose parents are crooked investors becomes an IRS attorney so she can take them down. But while she's at a job interview with another crooked businessman, he mistakes her for an FBI agent and tries to kill her. And a real FBI agent comes to her rescue. And they team up basically to take down her parents, even though her parents are willing to go to really extreme lengths to protect their own wealth and prestige. Our reviewer says there's occasional cumbersome writing, but it's a great plot with strong characters and red-hot romance. We also review But My Boyfriend Is by K.A. Mitchell. This is a really interesting exploration of homophobia that's both societal and internalized in a dramatic and erotic interracial gay romance. It's a matchup between a man who enjoys cruising for men in the park but can't admit that he's gay, and a fellow who's out and proud, except when it might risk his job as a physical trainer for a sports team. After the first man's brother is gay-bashed, the second must decide, will he protect his job or will he testify against the attackers? And there's more passion than plot, but fans of angsty, hurt comfort romance and athletic gay sex won't mind. In nonfiction, we have a Q&A with Jonathan Kozel, author of Fire in the Ashes. We also review A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi by Aman Sethi. He's an award-winning journalist for The Hindu, and he delivers a moving and irrepressible work of narrative reporting that captures the lives and voices of the homeless laborers and the Bharatuti Chowk in Old Delhi. The Chowk is a labor market where every alleyway, lane, and dead end has a story, and he focuses on a homeless house painter and construction worker who finds jobs by waiting in the early morning along the road. It's an acerbic, bombastic, and philosophical work, makes for wonderful reading. We also cover Let Me Clear My Throat, essays by Elena Passarello, who explores the ways that voices can entertain us, connect us, ruin us, vent our pains, and tether us to a place or tradition. She talks about sports announcer Myron Cope, about Marlon Brando, even Frank Sinatra's pamphlet, Tips on Popular Singing. And the essays from Passarello are interspersed with brief monologues from voiceover artists, auctioneers, American Idol contestants, holy rollers, and other people who live and die by their voices. We cover From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia. This is by historian and international affairs commentator Pankaj Mishra. And it looks at how between 1870 and 1940, some of the most intelligent and sensitive people in the East responded to the encroachments of the West on their societies. And in particular, he focuses on some intellectuals and political activists. And we called it well-researched and crisply written. And finally, we have a book that's sure to be controversial. This is The Pope's Jews, The Vatican's Secret Plans to Save the Jews from the Nazis by Gordon Thomas. It's generally believed that Pope Pius XII stood silently by while Hitler killed millions of Jews. And there have been many books to that effect, a lot of research. But in this novel, nonfiction work, the Pope, who's usually thought of as Hitler's Pope, is actually given some credibility back. This draws upon Vatican archival material available to only a few scholars. The rest of the archive won't even be opened until 2020. And also interviews with survivors, Vatican insiders, and it firmly challenges the long-standing view that Pius XII sat on his hands and did nothing. His argument goes against many historians' views, so it will ignite a contentious debate about the interpretation of his evidence and Pius's role during the Holocaust.
Well, certainly it seems as if scandal and debate are something that are going to be with the Vatican for some time to come, Rose, if that book has anything to say about it. In audio, what have we got?
We have a great fiction title. This is Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel, and it's a sequel to Wolf Hall, which certainly got a lot of acclaim. Here it's read by narrator Simon Vance, who shines in his portrayal of the characters, focusing on Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, Thomas Cromwell, and young lady-in-waiting Jane Seymour. He creates a range of distinct voices, including the increasingly tense Anne, and the Ernest Gregory, who is Thomas Cromwell's mild-mannered young son who is eager to prove himself. The narrator captures the soul of this complex character, complex book, and he also nails Cromwell's bone-dry wit. An exemplary audiobook, says our reviewer.
Well, you know, you would be tense, too, if you were married to Henry VIII, I think.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Indeed. In nonfiction, what have we got?
The nonfiction audiobook is Rather Outspoken, My Life in the News, by Dan Rather, obviously the legendary newsman, and he charts the course of his career, highlighting the highs, the lows, the controversy, his dismissal from CBS, and the biggest stories he covered, including the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the atrocities of Abu Ghraib. He narrates the book himself, of course. He turns in a professional and compelling performance. His narration is sonorous, clear, and smooth. You can hear it now, right? Anyone who's ever seen Dan Rather on the news can recall that voice. It's a great voice. And he offers up a reading that is both straightforward and personal. In our online annex this week, we have the erudite and entertaining Something Like the Gods, A Cultural History of the Athlete from Achilles to LeBron. And Stephen Amidon examines the athlete as Western icon, drawing from a vast and diverse range of sources and deftly balancing big picture assessments with popular case studies. And we have a review of Parmi Olsen's We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of Lulzsec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. And this is a spellbinding account of mischief and mayhem in the internet age, with all the makings of a fast-paced espionage thriller, even though it's entirely non-fictional, based on plenty of research and interviews. And finally, I wanted to mention that this is the semi-annual announcements issue. We have heaps of listings in each editor's picks of the top 10 fall and winter books in their categories. So this is going to be a hefty issue of PW, definitely worth picking up.
Well, we look forward to that. And as always, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor and blogger at Somerville, thanks so much.
All right, you're very welcome.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to our free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.